so.
I'll start with introductions. I'm Del Brady, the chairman of the board in the Northeast region. To my far left, Jake Albrecht from the Southern region. Next to him, Ernie Pete Perkins from the Northern region. My immediate right is Director Jim Karpowicz. And next is John Baer from the Central region and Mike King from the Southeast region. I recognize we have two board members, Calvin Crandall and Bill Fenimore, not here with us today. We also have the women that keep us in line, Stacy Coons, representative support for the Wildlife Board, and Luann Petrovic. Luann, I understand this may be your last day, is that right? Thank you so much for all you've done to help us.
Is Stacy that hard on you that you got to move on?
From Iraq, over here, from the northern region, Robert Burns from the northeast region. Looks like we've got Boyd Blackwell. We don't have our chairman there. Fred Oswald from the central region. Darius Jones from the southeast region. And I suspect we got the southern region, Steve, on his way. With that, we welcome all of you that are here today. I'll start off asking for an approval of our minutes. The board, do we have any comments? I'm looking for Ernie. You had something.
So moved.
A second. Second by Mike King. All in favor of approval of minutes? Unanimous. Thank you. Old business action log. Ernie, if you will take that.
Yes, sir. We got basically four items that we're going to mention today. On the action log, then, the first item will be on the RAC tour, which is a preference point system with the new 30-unit deer plan. That'll be on the RAC tour this month and will come to the board the beginning of next month. The second item on the action log is a conservation permit program report. That will be presented today, agenda item number 9. I'd like to get a motion to close that one right now. And if we want to do something different, we can add a new action log item.
Moved.
Moved second. By John Baer. Seconded by Jake Albrecht to close the, pardon? No. This closes the second item, the conservation permit program report on the action log. And all in favor?
Aye.
The third item then is the convention permit meetings, and I believe Director Karpowicz is going to give us report on his actions.
Yeah, I'll just give you a quick update. You've seen the letter that I sent out. The board gave us a year to do this, but due to a retirement, I thought I better hurry and get this done sooner than that. And so we moved ahead and did exactly what the board asked us to do. We followed a three-step process in meeting with the convention groups and with United Wildlife Cooperative. I first met with them separately, each group separately, and talked about options and to see if we could find some resolution. And then we met collectively as a group, all three groups, and narrowed the concerns and tried to see if there was some common ground where we could address the public's concerns. In the end, we identified four primary areas that are in the letter that that UWC felt like if those were part of the contract that they would be satisfied with the program, at least for the time being. And so we had Marty draft an amendment to the contract. This is a voluntary amendment, and the groups agreed to it, and they have signed that amendment. And it is it's now complete and in effect. And the amendment also includes the board motion on an annual report. And so I'm hopeful that that will put this issue to rest for now, and that all of these groups can get back to working on their missions as conservation groups, and that this controversy will now be put to rest. And if there's any questions, I can answer that, but I'd like to compliment the convention groups on their willingness to make these changes. They were voluntary. They didn't have to do it, and they stepped forward and did it, and they should be complimented.
Are there any questions from the board or comments from the board members?
Just good job. Get it done.
Yeah, I was going to all echo that.
Just a thanks for Jim for taking care of that.
Yeah, that needs to be said. Thank you, Jim. And I think I'd like to compliment all of the groups that participated, MDF, SFW, and the Wildlife Cooperative. Every one of them gave, compromised. It's good to see that kind of a thing going on to get something very productive done compared to other things we're witnessing. So thank you, Jim. Could I get a motion to close that action log item then, please? By Jake, seconded by John. All in favor?
Aye.
And it's unanimous. And the last item we're going to work on today is next to last item on the log. It's an interim report as proposed by the division on female harvest of cougars. And I believe John Shivick has a presentation for us that the board asked for in the August board meeting.
What you doing sitting in the back, John?
Don't actually have a presentation for you. I have basically we just put together this report, gave it to the board, provided it to the houndsmen and folks, so you guys had all the information that we have. What it comes down to, though, in summary, is looking at the data, looking at the biology of cougars, and understanding the situation, the size of the units. We'd acknowledge that the plan with cougars is an aggressive plan in the state, but we're following the plan, and what we're just about to get to the end of the three-year cycle, and at the end of this spring, summer, we'll have good data to be able to put together strong recommendations, and I want to do these recommendations working with the houndsmen and, you know, going through the regular public process, and I think we should be able to incorporate a lot of their suggestions. A lot of their suggestions are quite good, and I think we'll get them in there. It's just a matter of timing. It seemed to me that the largest part of this inquiry had to do with timing. Is there an emergency? Do we need to do it right now, or can we do it as according to the plan? And after looking at the data, it really comes down to timing. There's no imminent threat of losing cougars in the state, and we can make our adjustments according to the plan here this spring and summer. And the last final little note I put on that, I did want to propose increasing our relationship and working with the houndsmen. I would like to do a more detailed study on the Wasatch Manti, get these guys involved in treeing, getting biological samples, and actually getting a mark recapture genetic analysis of the population there, so we're all on the same page. And I've already done what I can so far to try to find funds to do that. So that's the extent of the report. You all have it, and I'd be happy to answer any questions about it, though, if you still have some.
Questions from the board members?
I got a couple questions for you, John.
Sure, John.
I got a letter here from Andy. I'm sure you know Andy pretty well by now. Me and Andy hunt the same canyons and grew up a couple blocks from each other, and I know him very well. We, and I know we have a couple comment cards having to deal with this, but I know it's just an action log item. What is the, if we were to make a couple changes this year, as far, I know that the big concerns are sheep units and the manti units, particularly the two west units that have, I mean, if you used to ask a houndsman to draw up the perfect unit to hunt lions on, you'd get the west manti, the north and the south. And we've been over all the concerns many times where the sheep units are, we want harvest there. They are, you know, we want to concentrate the harvest there, but they're the much more difficult units to hunt. They're 20 minutes from the north manti. There's no reason in the world I'm going to go turn my dogs loose on the Cascade unit when they're going to end up down in town and on the highway and in the ledges when in a half hour I can be on the north manti. I know the houndsmen have some real concerns about letting this go another year. I know we're 2 years into a three-year deal. Is there any reason we couldn't make a couple changes without nuking our whole plan and screwing up our data?
It's not that extreme. It's not about nuking or screwing up data or whatever. I mean, obviously, the board can, you guys can take action, you know, however you like. I would just still stand by the recommendation that we have a plan, we have a process, and I'm confident in that process and in that plan, and I'm confident in the numbers that we have. And especially when we're talking about controversial animals like predators, you know, I think it's really important to have the good data and the good numbers as we go forward and make recommendations. I think, you know, part of my job here is to protect cougar populations, to make sure these things are still healthy, and bears and all these critters that a lot of people don't see as favorably. I don't want to get us into a place where we are making what looks like rash and immediate decisions without all the information or without any indication of a real emergency. I think that could backfire. And that's my concern.
I understand where you're coming from and the importance of sticking to a plan. Having hunted these units and kind of sharing the concerns of two concerns that I think I share with some of these houndsmen is the pressure we want on the sheep units are going to the two manti units that can take 10 or 12 years to draw a tag on. And, you know, I'm leery about letting that problem ride another year.
I think it's a matter of timing. I think in all the letters, proposals, numbers, or suggestions that I've received, there's some, like I said, some really good ideas in there. And I think we're going to make some changes. I think I want to propose those changes next time around to separate out this predator. Mm. This is bigger than just that unit.
You understand the concerns, though, very well.
Absolutely. I completely understand. And I think there's some relevant concerns there. The difference is this an emergency that we need to stop the whole, derail the train and...
Because I know that the houndsmen feel it is a dire emergency. You, just so we're clear and I understand your position, you don't feel like letting it ride for another year will decimate the lion population like the houndsmen are concerned that it will.
It will not bring it to some unrecoverable. No, the cougars. Again, like I said, it is an aggressive plan. They're being hit hard, but are they going to be driven to extinction in the state? No, I I'm confident that we can make our adjustments this next spring. We're only talking a couple months now. We'll make our adjustments and we'll get back on top of it. And I'm not concerned about any imminent threat.
Okay.
But I, yeah.
Well, Ernie, I know we have a couple comment cards. I know it's an action log item, so I guess I know it's pretty clear where I stand on the issue, and I know, I think John's, I appreciate his willingness to talk and to deal with everybody on here, but I guess I'd have to leave it to Ernie and Dale to, you know, how we want to deal with this, if we're going to entertain anything or if what we want to do.
I'll tell you, it is an action log item. There are, I suspect, significant number of our public here because of that action log item. Ernie's still in charge of that. I'm going to leave that to him, but we have one comment card. We will hear that comment card. If there's any others, we'll take that, but I'm going to limit it to about three at the max comment cards, so 3 minutes per each, because I suspect we're all here for the same agenda. We don't have time to go through the whole public process, but I'm sure three of you can speak for the group. We can do that and give you say, but at this point in time, being an action log item, I'm reluctant to for the board to make any decision at this point in time.
I'd definitely be interested in hearing what they have to say. Like I said, I think they've made a good faith effort to work through the process, and I think they deserve to be heard, and then we can decide, I guess, after that.
And Kevin, did you have something you wanted to say before we step into that?
Just quickly, to put the, I agree, John, the idea of not putting pressure on sheep units and putting that on the Manti, I would have that concern if I thought it was really occurring. The reason I don't think it is because the Manti units are all split units. So up until the end of February, if you want to harvest a cat, unless you have a limited entry tag, you have to go to those sheep units. You can't start harvesting until, and granted, if we have a late snow year, you can have significant harvest after. But during those best times, during the very best snow times of the year, end of December, January, February, if you want to take a cat on a harvest objective tag, you don't have any other choice but to go to those sheep units. So it's not like it's that way year round. That does occur after the transition to the split. So I just wanted to make that clear. So.
And one last question before we go to the public. There still is an emergency shutoff switch throughout next spring in terms of the director putting an emergency closure on any unit, isn't there?
I think our emergency shutoff switch is retiring in a couple of weeks, so.
He will be replaced. As all of us who have retired know, there is no indispensable person in the world. So that is always an option if a much higher than anticipated harvest starts occurring.
Of course.
Okay. Okay, with that, I now have two cards, so we'll allow those two people to address. I think we'd be interested in hearing new information as opposed to a rehash of the stuff that we've covered in multiple emails and at least one other meeting. So let me call Jason Adamson first, please. 3 minutes, Jason, and thank you.
Hello, you guys. Thanks for hearing us today. I really appreciate it.
State your name, if you would, Jason.
My name is Jason Adamson. I live down in San Pete County, and this is a real problem, a major problem. And I think John, where he's had some experience down there, he understands it. He understands our problem here. And first of all, I want to let you guys know I appreciate you. Tamara's handing out some information that I gathered over the last few days on the Internet on these cats. As for John's letter, you know, John is a great guy. And John's doing his best to do a great job. John's only been in this position for a little over a year. A lot of us have a lot more experience than that. I've been chasing these cats for over 25 years. I do understand this, and there's a lot of us that do. And I love to hunt deer, too. I want you to know that. As for John, in his letter, he claims these cats are all having a home range of 250 to 300 square miles. That sounds great. but according to the Nevada Department of Wildlife, their males live an average of 31 miles from where they were born. Their females live an average of 18 miles from where they were born. In Diablo, California, males live an average of 35 miles from where they were born. These cats are staying in the same unit, especially since we've gone to these huge units. So for us to wipe out these units, we're wiping out the seed too. And when they're traveling that far, we've taken away these sink areas that they so-called talk about that these cats are staying in and are going to reproduce in these areas. Those cats are killed out. If they're traveling that kind of miles, they're killed out. There are no sink units. Okay. He also states cougar populations can rebound relatively quickly if hunting is reduced. Tell that to the biologists in Yellowstone. They decimated a population in 1920. It's on your paper. In 1920, except for a few transients passing through, there were no resident cougars lived there for almost 50 years. 50 years, that isn't soon enough for me. Kerry Murphy directs this study, and as of 1991, they estimated 14 to 17 resident lions live in Yellowstone. I don't think we want to do that to our home range. My boy would be 64 years old by the time they come back. He's 14 now. John's graph shows a perfect controlled limited entry unit in the Elkers. When you look at that, that stays pretty level. Just the way the director said is perfect management last meeting. Very little fluctuation. Limited entry works very well. Now look at the Monroe and consider the surrounding areas are being hit just as hard, and there are no sinkholes to bring it back. Clint Meekham gave me the numbers here recently on the collared cats. He had 20 cats collared. Of those 20, 8 were killed in the first weeks of the quota split unit. 8. In 3 weeks. We had 2 more months on that hunt. 2 more months to go. So we killed half the cats in 3 weeks.
I'm going to ask you to cut this short.
All right, I'll hurry. So with 2 months left, so we took our average of 2.5 cats per kilometer, cut it to 1.25 in 1 unit in 3 weeks. John says the plan employs a biological index, and only one of the management areas meets this and is not the Wasatch. We shouldn't have that problem to explain, but this management unit's only been in going for 1 year. He counted 2. He counted the year that it was limited entry also.
Okay, I don't know what you've got left, but I do need to keep the meeting moving along, so I'm going to ask you to cut her off if you can.
Okay, I'm almost done. Split unit was open for 4 days in 2010. They killed 11 cats. It was open for 3 months. In 2012, they killed 18 cats and 7 females.
Can we just stop right there?
I just want to say one last thing. One last thing, okay? In the last meeting, I gained a great deal of respect for Director Karpwich and noticed what a leader he is, and he talked about this. He said, "We just changed 2 management plans today, elk and buffalo. Good management is being able to adapt. I think adaptive management is needed here."
Thank you.
Thank you. Chet Young.
Chet Young. I'm representing the Utah Houndsman Association today. It's not so much the plan that the Houndsman Association feels that's the problem. This has actually been, these Manti units have been going on since 2009. I'd just like to read a few words from the 2009 meeting. If y'all remember, it was to put them Manti units on a straight up harvest objective. We went to lunch. The board actually brought it back to the surface and changed that to a split. And in 2009, Justin Shannon said that when we went to harvest objective there, they killed cats very quickly, and it was closed in just over a week. The percent females taken increased substantially, and the following years, the age in the animals decreased quite a bit. When you go to harvest objective on the Manti, local biologists you really impact the population quickly. Because of access and the success that is possible, in talking with local biologists, they did not see response in the deer herd. Mr. Bonnell said, despite reducing the cougar density, we saw very little response to the deer herd. This shows the cougars were not the problem. Director Karpowitz said, we need to do the right thing for the deer herd and do everything we can, but we need to do the right thing. I have been a proponent of accelerated cougar harvest over the years, and we have done a lot of this. I am doing all we can to help the deer herd, but let's be sure we are doing the right thing. So back in 2009, when the Manti units became a split, we obviously had people that were worried that we were going too far at the time. You know, people with a lot of respect with the division. And now we're combining them with the sheep units at a real high harvest rate. You know, it really scares us as houndsmen. John is already talking that next year when this comes about, he can see that there's a problem and there's an issue. Well, if we can see there's a problem and an issue, let's try to plan it out now instead of letting it go way down and then in a year try to bring it back. We'd just like to try to maintain it from now instead of losing it. The letter you guys got from Andy Lyons, actually, I wrote that letter and gave it to him, and I didn't want to flood you guys with emails, so that is the houndsman's proposal. We'd just like to see them sheep units split away. You still have the same amount of tags for all 9 units. Okay. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Is there any board member that wishes to make further comment? John?
I don't like letting this go another year. I just don't think it's the thing to do. I know I'm outnumbered on this one, but I just don't think it's the thing to do. And going along with kind of what Kevin said, I understand it's a split unit. I think if we was to adjust the numbers on the harvest objective side of the season, that, you know, we could accomplish what we needed to. But I don't like where it's headed, so I'll just say that. I think that
it would be totally inappropriate for us to take any action at this meeting, because we'd be cutting out a huge number of the public. However, that wouldn't preclude asking the division to take something out. So it could go through an entire process. So do you want to make a motion with that?
Well, I guess if we're not going to make a motion to adjust things right now, I mean, how would we? I guess I need you to explain what you're saying a little better.
I believe it could go out at the November rack for a decision on the December board meeting. Well, all I'm doing is pointing out a possible. Yes, Jim.
I see two or three options here for the board. One is certainly to do nothing and let it go another year, as has been recommended by John. I think it's really problematic to try and change the direction of the plan, unit boundaries, season dates that are already in print. That becomes a law enforcement issue and a big concern. The one step in between those two is to adjust the harvest objective quota. And there's two ways to accomplish that. The board could do it now. They could do it after it went through the rack and the board. Or you could leave it to the division director to do it as an emergency closure if it looks like things are excessive as the season progresses. So this isn't an all or nothing situation, and the board has some options, but those are the options that I see. It is getting way late in the process to make any major adjustments, but the quota – could be adjusted.
Thank you for outlining the options. John, do you wish to do anything? Or?
Well, I would. If there's any way we could adjust the quote or put some kind of stipulation on there that if during the harvest objective part of the season, you know, that if it hits, I would say we probably, my preference would be to lower the quota. And if we could send that out to, on the, you know, at the next RAC meeting or something. I understand what the director's saying. To change boundaries and stuff at this point would be extremely problematic. But to lower the quota so that the, if there's any way we could do that, so that those manti units, like Jason said, we don't kill 8 in a weekend.
Just need to point out one thing. The next round is the big game round, and you're very liable to get a very different perspective on cougar harvest at that round.
I understand that. I talked to John about that too. I told him I didn't know that it was the right thing to do to feed him to the wolves at the big game meeting by recommending a reduction in cougar harvest, but I know that wouldn't be quite as friendly of a crowd to that way of thinking.
Okay, but I'm going to take John's comment as the concept of a motion. Is there a board member that would second that motion?
I have a question before we do this. If you're to lower the quota, what's the basis for the number that you set it at? Is there a biological basis? Is enough work been done to know what the quota should be at this point? I mean, I don't know.
Let me call on John.
For those listening, I'm shrugging. I don't have a good, I mean, again, we have our plan. We have the numbers. We will have the numbers. And it will say, you know, if things keep going, you know, I don't know what the ultimate is going to be, but it might tell us to reduce permits by 20% or by 25%. Or I might look at it and in discussions, we might want to redefine what our baseline is for these permit numbers. But for right now, the simplest answer to your question is the biological basis is what's in the plan, which is what I'm trying to follow.
What would be the basis for an emergency closure? What would trigger the director saying killed too many? It's an emergency closure.
If I saw some, I think if the biology were different, that the cougars don't move around, that this was a broad scale over the whole unit, over the whole state, over this kind of thing, I think that would be the trigger, at least in my mind. It'd have to be up to the director for the specifics of when he'd want to pull that trigger. But again, we're talking about a pretty small area in the state of Utah. And some people that are obviously and understandably passionate about that one, about this one unit. But I'm thinking in the big scale in terms of the state and the big scale in terms of time. And, you know, we haven't gotten to that emergency. So I don't know how to answer your question. I can't, you know, when I look at the numbers, we're okay.
I got a question for, I guess, the three of you here. If we go a week into the harvest objective and we've killed 10 cats and they're all on the manti, are we concerned? Because I mean, that's a big unit, and when you look at the spreadsheet on the division's website that just says, well, that what are we calling it? It's not an eco region anymore. What is it? What are we calling it?
We're calling it a cougar management area.
The cougar management area, but we know all those cats come off one little area. I mean, are we really achieving our goal? Because to me, that's worst case scenario, and that's what we're scared of.
Right, and I'm having.
Can we take action then?
I'm having a little difficulty answering that because I'm getting two directions. One, you know, the plan puts it together on an area. And I'm trying my best to follow what I was instructed to do and approved by the board and gone through the whole RAC process. I'm really just doing my best to follow the process and not to be arbitrary or anything about it. So from the way the plan's written now and the way the things were done, we're fine with it. We're looking at it as an area. Could that be tweaked? I don't think that's a bad idea to tweak it. The only thing I'm saying is that I think it's going to be important, especially with this species, to follow our process. And if we need to adjust permits, to adjust them according to what the plan says, not, I worry about shoot from the hip and seeming capricious or arbitrary about these kinds of things. That's all.
Then, Dale.
Just make a comment, going back to what Director Karpowitz said, and we've seen him several times in the past exercise his executive authority to take care of wildlife in the state of Utah under different situations. And I could cite a few examples, but I won't, but I've seen it. And I have full confidence in the leadership of the DWR, our directors, Karpowitz in the past, and we'll have a new one, and whoever that may be, he's going to have the responsibility and certainly the capability to do the same. I am more comfortable with leaving it in the DWR's executive closure, if that, whatever you want to put that term on. Let them call the shots, because Kevin and you, you're the ones that are going to be gathering the information, John. So we need to, you guys are going to forward that on to the director. You're all going to be on full alert if something happens, like we've done with, like, say, the Parker Mountain antelope or some of those other elk units that have been shut off or cut off. I'm more comfortable. We stay with the plan, and if we see a real problem, the DWR has got to exercise that authority, and will do and have done in the past.
Jim.
Let me just expand on that a little. I want to ask John if, and John Bear asked this question in a different form, but do you see circumstances where if the harvest started coming in a certain way, a large number of females or juveniles or something, and lots of complaints that there's no cougar tracks, do you see a situation where you would recommend to the director an emergency closure on that unit?
If we, you know, the one definite way I can answer that, if we start blowing past a quota, for instance, or something, or start where it looks like we're, it's difficult to argue when we're nowhere near quotas that there's an emergency. So when we're still 80% of what the quota is, it's difficult to say, yes, I'm going to recommend it. If all of a sudden that whole unit or the whole area starts really getting hammered terribly, no, I mean, I take it as my job still to worry about these populations. If we really start flying and it looks like we're going to fly past this quota or something like that, then I would be in your office saying, we need to look at this and deal with this situation. Absolutely. I'm just having a problem envisioning that right now.
I understand we need to move on, and we're taking a lot of time on this. Could I make one request to Kevin and John, and I'll move on?
Yeah. Can I say something before you do, John?
Sure.
And just in response to what Dale said, and out of respect for our new director, we don't like to put our director in that situation. In fact, we go out of our way to try to not put the director in that sort of a situation. So if the board's concerned that we're going to be there, as a division, we would much rather you direct us to take something out. We've got the quotas, the split thing doesn't start until March. We could take that through and change quotas. People have to call in on those anyway. They're published on the web. There's a phone line. That can be done without changing anything in the guidebook or anything that's in print. If you're concerned enough that you think that's going to develop, I think as a division, we would rather take that through the public process than put that pressure on our director to have to make that decision. And so if you're at a level of concern where you're afraid that might develop, we would rather take it out. through the process.
I would ask you to look at one thing. It's a big, big unit. I know when we put these numbers together, we anticipate a certain amount of that harvest. Well, we anticipate that harvest being spread over the whole unit.
Right.
Is that right?
And that's what I was going to say in response to the question to John. If we saw a high number of females coming from a small area, that would send up red flags.
That's what I would ask you guys to do. And I think that the houndsman, that's our concern, is that the South Manti and the North Manti are going to take the brunt of that harvest. You know, like Jason says, it was opened over a weekend a couple of years ago, and we blew by the quota. If the limited entry guys fill up and we have good snow, can we please look, not a month down the road, if things start to shape up and those cats start coming in and they're coming in off the Manti, I mean, that's our concern. Particularly females, you know, that would be something that we need to keep an eye on. And, you know, if it looks like we can't let all those lions in that quota come off those two units. Like Jason said, there won't be nothing left. My kid that's 15 will be 80 by the time we find him something to chase. I don't want that. I don't think anybody in here wants that. And we need to, you know, if we can keep an eye on that, I think that's the concern. And if we can commit to the houndsman that we would take that into consideration and not say, well, you know, our quota isn't full yet, but we know full well that the brunt of that harvest is coming off those two units and look to make an adjustment there. I think that's what they're asking for, and I think they'd be okay with that. So
I do want to make it clear, we are paying attention to this. We are discussing this. We are looking at the numbers and watching them. Spent a lot of time generating these reports for you. And I'm sensitive to what the houndsmen are saying. And I just want to reiterate that I agree with where they're coming from. And I want to work with them to make sure that they know that we're protecting these animals. We're not trying to wipe them out.
Well, and I'm sure Jason and some of the guys down there will be in contact with you. And if things start to shape up, I'm sure you'll be hearing about it. So
that's my pleasure.
Once again, Mr. Chairman and Ernie, I apologize for taking so much time, but I think these guys have put a lot of effort into this. So with that, I think
we all agree. The public has a right to be heard, and their concerns deserve to be addressed.
And where it's Jim's last meeting, I didn't want to let him off the hook too easy. So
now, I think I just heard you say, John, if I interpreted correctly, that you're prepared to withdraw your motion, and that could be done since there was no second.
Yeah, just I think that, you know, if these guys will keep an eye on that and keep an eye on the concerns and not let it get just clobbered before we do something, if it looks like something really over the top's going to happen, I think that's what we're concerned about.
Would you like me, as we watch what the harvest is, as females come in, to make sure you guys have that real-time information?
Yeah, I would like that.
And then if it looks like there's something people are not comfortable with, I'll be happy to do that for you.
Because I think as the snow piles up and we can see how the limited entry guys doing that, I mean, we can kind of see what's coming. So
that's one of the difficulties, and that's one of the good thing about the multiple year, the 3 years, because any one year, we'll see what happens. It could be a really easy year, it could be a little hard year, and we'll adjust appropriately. I think it's great. I'll watch those numbers, we'll watch those females, and we'll stay on top of it and make sure you're in.
And be ready to, if.
Yeah, you're
okay, John, how will you communicate? Thank you very much for your offer. It's a great offer. And with that, I think I'm going to move this along and return the meeting to Dell.
This the question. I wonder how you would communicate that information.
Stacy is the master of communication with the board. I've already spoken. I've called John and emailed him, and I've been trying to keep him in the loop on some of these things, and I'll continue to do that. And to whatever extent, speed dial every board member and call you guys every day if I need to.
We'll add a file to your Dropbox, and you'll have it on your iPad. We'll go that route.
And I'll call too.
Just for Stacy's information, there's been discussion between board members about limiting the number of pages in Dropbox. However, now to move this along, get it back to Dell. That then, if there's no further input, closes this item on the action log for today. It then remains on the action log for fall 2014 as published. Back to you, sir.
Okay. Thank you, Ernie. That's the first time I've seen the action log take that long. We just finished item number two of our agenda. We'll go to item number three and have an update from Director Karpowicz.
Okay, thank you. I'll try and be brief. Stacy can put me on the timer if she wants. There. But I know there's some things of interest to the board that I need to mention. First of all, our thoughts and prayers go out to Bill Fenimore today. I believe he's in surgery today.
Yeah, his surgery is scheduled for 3 o'clock for a new pacemaker defibrillator for those that know him. And on the other issues that developed over the last week, he's making progress. So this one is a major step and needs to happen.
So some very serious surgery today, and our thoughts go out to him. I also want to thank Lou Ann. A lot of great service, and she's done a great job over the years, and we appreciate all the good work she's done. First of all, I want to update you on the deer hunt. I know that's a concern to the board where we've gone to a new system. We saw some interesting things on the deer hunt this year. We actually saw a significantly improved deer hunt. Numbers of deer at our checking stations increased. Just some preliminary data. Last year at our several deer checking stations, we checked 552 deer. This year at those same stations, 910. So that's a significant increase in deer harvest and quite a few older bucks than we've seen in the past. We also have the preliminary muzzleloader harvest data, and that success rate increased from about 20% to 32%. So we saw a much better deer hunt this year than we've seen in the past, and that's a good thing. We seem to be moving in the right direction. As we do our postseason deer classification, we'll see what the buck-doe ratios look like after the hunt, but a much improved deer hunt. Also very important is we saw deer coming through the checking stations in reasonably good shape considering the miserable drought we experienced this summer, and that's encouraging. They had actually, we had a lot of big bucks, and it looked like the deer were in superb shape, but big bucks always have more fat on them, as you can see from up here. And
older ones.
Sorry. But actually, it's about an average amount of fat, and that's good considering the summer conditions. The next thing I want to update you on is the law enforcement efforts during the deer hunt. I know the board's concerned of how the new boundaries worked out. We actually had very few problems with boundaries considering we went to 30 units. In fact, we had far fewer boundary problems than when we went to 5 regions several years ago. So hunters understood the boundaries. They stayed within their units, and the hunt went reasonably well. I think the jury's still out whether people like the new system. We had a lot of mixed reports. Some people thought it was great. Some people thought it was awful. So, but we didn't experience many problems. That doesn't mean there were not a lot of law enforcement concerns during the hunt. Trying to find my sheet here, but that we still responded to a lot of illegal kills and illegal activity, but not related to unit boundaries. Next thing I wanted to let you know about is our fire rehab efforts. As you know, we burned almost 500,000 acres in Utah this summer. Fortunately, we have a very good habitat program, and we're able to respond to that very quickly. We have, to date, we've mixed 1.1 million pounds of seed and distributed it to be put on the ground by aircraft and by ground. We have two shifts working night and day, 10 semi-trailers full of seed moving continuously to move seed to these areas to rehab them. Chains, harrows, equipment moving at a rapid pace, and we're responding very quickly. We're running out of time now, and we're up against the wall. We've got still got a lot to do before the snow flies, but we've got a lot of more than half of the seed out now. We are very concerned that the BLM's money for fire rehab was cut dramatically, and they don't have near the money they need to rehab BLM lands. We're going to try and make up some of that slack, but it's very disappointing to us that they don't have the money to get the seed on the ground where they need to in fire rehab areas, and that's a concern to us. And we are also operating on money we don't have. We have a commitment from the legislature where we're putting out over $8 million to get this seed on the ground, and we're betting that we'll be reimbursed with that at some point during this next session. So we're doing this in good faith to make sure these damaged rangelands get rehab. So I wanted to update you on that. Just a couple other things. Fall fishing is in full swing. It's been phenomenal this year. Anybody that's been out, there's been some really good fishing around the state, and it's a real credit to our aquatics personnel that are doing a great job. You probably want to report on the coyote bounty program. We've already bountied over 1,000 coyotes. They're starting to come in big numbers now as the trappers, as furs become prime and as trappers head out. We're starting to see large numbers of coyotes come in around the state, that's encouraging. We also have desert bighorn sheep in transit to Utah as we speak for release on the Kaparowitz unit. We have 50 sheep coming, and that's a good thing. Just finally, we've mentioned it today, but this is my last wildlife board meeting. I've done this for a long time now, 34 years, 7.5 years as director. I've got to tell you, with all the wildlife boards I've worked with, I think this is the very best. I think we've got a great board here, and they do a very good job of listening and responding to the public and of managing our wildlife in the state, and I want to wish you the best of luck. We'll have a new director announced shortly. The interviews have already taken place. Everybody that's been interviewed has become strangely silent, so we don't know what's going on, but sometime, I think, within the next week, we should know who the new director's going to be. I don't know if we got a copy of it to you or not, but I sent out a list to our employees last week of the major accomplishments of the division over the last 7 years, and it's really an impressive list, and I'm really proud of our people and all they've done for wildlife. It really is significant. We've hit some huge milestones. 1 million acres of habitat improvement. 1 million acres. I mean, we couldn't even imagine that 7 years ago, and it feels pretty good to have helped Kevin Conway realize his vision of improving habitat in this state. A lot of other things. Our hatcheries, for the first time, are in all hatcheries in production. First time in more than a decade, and that feels pretty good. 20,000 acres of Phragmites treated to improve waterfowl hunting in the state. Community fishing ponds increased from 19 to 50. Walk-in access program with 80,000 acres in it and 40 miles of fishing streams, and on and on and on. And I just want to say it's a great credit to our people in this agency that work so hard, and they do a great job. We also have worked hard to increase opportunities for sportsmen. We've increased anglers by about 90,000. We have more people applying in our big game draw every year. 330,000 people apply for big game permits in this state, and there's still high interest in this state in fishing and hunting and other wildlife activities. There's a lot of challenges ahead for the wildlife, but I can tell you this agency's up to them. We have a great process, public process in place with RACs and the board, and it allows a huge amount of public participation in our process, and it's allowed us to be successful as a wildlife agency. So I'd just like to thank the Wildlife Board, like to thank all of the division employees and of our many partners in the state, the sportsmen of this state, and all of the people that love wildlife. We couldn't be successful as an agency without public participation. And the conservation groups, the sportsmen's groups that work so closely with us are very integral to our success. So we got some really good things going in Utah. Sometimes success creates issues with some people, but I got to tell you, there's nothing like this around the West. We are doing some really good things in this state, and it's because people in this state, employees in this agency, the Wildlife Board, the RACs, are passionate about wildlife and what we do, and the results have been just amazing. So thanks to all of you. I wish the new director luck. I think it's going to be a little tough for his first board meeting to be the big game board meeting, but comes with the territory.
I'll take care of me.
So anyway, thanks, and good luck to all of you.
Thank you, Jim. I first heard the name of Jim Karpowitz back in the late 70s when I was in Cedar City and understood that he was a sheep biologist and was the guy to go to. And I haven't really known him personally other than watching for years until the last 8 or 10 years when I've been on the rack and the board. And what he has just said, I second. He's not blowing smoke. As we go to these other meetings, I'll pick on the tri-state meeting where Utah, Colorado, and Wyoming get together every year. They are blown away when they find out what Utah is doing. Their habitat, they can't believe the acreages of improvement that we make. Just this last September when we was over there, they handed out charts and graphs showing where their license sales have gone. Their fishing is all going down. And what Director Karpowitz has said is true. Ours is going up. So there's a lot of things that Jim can be proud of. But we, as sportsmen in the state of Utah, owe Director Karpowitz a big, big thank you. And Jim, I personally thank you. With that, we need to move on. We will start with agenda item number 4, our fishing guidebook, Drew Cushing.
All right. Well, I thank you. I didn't realize cougar hunting was so controversial.
From a guy who has lakes chock full of predators.
I was texting one of our anglers in the room, and I said, angler reps are easy. They just want more and bigger. I said, not more and less. So I thank you, I got to recognize my counterpart, Paul Birdsey. He moved here from the Southeast region, and he is the new Coldwater Sport Fish Coordinator, and then I thank the Wildlife Board and Jim Karpowitz, who I'm going to miss as well. Just getting started here. The first one is basically an allowance of disposal. We have several issues here that anglers have to face when they go out and they number one, catch a common carp, either with a bow or spear fishing, or just catch it by regular angling. They have to determine what they're going to do with that. And, you know, when you're in one of these, especially these bow fishing contests, they catch maybe 1,000 pounds of these carp, and then they have to do something with them. And then there's the everyday guy who goes out and either, you know, shoots one or catches one out on the lake. You know, he may not want to eat it, but is putting it back in the lake alive the answer either? And then the second one there is the species of fish that we've deemed catch and kill because they were illegally introduced there. One of the issues is if you catch a 6-inch largemouth bass or a smallmouth bass that was illegally introduced there, and we have a catch and kill regulation on it, it's not big enough to take home. And so what do you do with it? You'd like them to kill it. By turning it back alive, they're technically in violation of the rule. And so what we'd like to do is address this in a statute, this 2320-8, and then take that to the legislature and then back before the Racks and Wildlife Board this next year. One of the things we have to address is, and it was brought to us by some bow anglers in the northern region, is how would we like them to dispose of those fish when they do catch them? And so we have a year from now to, you know, get that under wraps and come up with some outreach that'll help them understand, you know, what to do with those fish when they do catch it. Okay, now getting into the taking of game fish. We have a number of issues here. Right now we have it's a complicated regulation. You can use two hooks per line statewide except for two waters. And in those two waters are Flaming Gorge and Lake Powell, where you can use three. And what we're asking is to standardize this so that we can use three all across the state. Now, there's a couple reasons. One, in this setup on the lower left, which is a worm harness, I actually have that very rig in my tackle box, and if I bring it out to the lake, I'm technically in violation. You can see it has three hooks, and a lot of commercially available worm harnesses have three hooks. And so if you use them anywhere but Flaming Gorge or Lake Powell, you're in violation. Then we have these umbrella rigs, which are becoming really popular statewide. And they're available in sets of five, which you can see in the center upper. And those are, you know, right now, if you went to Lake Powell, you'd have to clip off two of those hooks. And then if you went anywhere else in the state, you'd have to clip three. And so we just like to make that easier for those folks that use those rigs. And then our fly anglers as well, for three consecutive years, have asked for allowance of three flies. And which, you know, when they mention it to me, makes sense. If you have a dry fly and then a middle nymph, so it'd go in the middle of the water column, and then a lower nymph that would drag the bottom, that would make sense to me. I'd probably knot it up, but it would be a good technique if you could keep it straight. So we're in support of this. Then this was actually brought up in the online survey that we did, which I'll talk a bit about a little later. And I really didn't realize how popular this was. A number of people brought it up in that survey, and I did some research in other states, especially in the South and Southeast. And it's extremely popular back there, and it's one where we do have an overabundance of common carp, as if you didn't know. And you know, this is a kind of a growth area where, you know, they want to bow fish at night for common carp. We don't have a lot of regular angling that takes place at night. We do have an overabundance of carp in a number of waters, and it also is a crossover sport where, you know, we could solicit or could attract hunters actually to take part in a kind of a crossover sport that meshes well with fishing. This is just bookkeeping. Right now, gizzard shad are prohibited to possess in our guidebook, but they're also allowed to use as bait at Lake Powell, and you're allowed to possess them dead. And what we'd like to do is just clean that up, and in the prohibited section, just put a little statement in there that says, except at Lake Powell, where they're prohibited to be used dead and possessed dead. Okay, regional recommendations. The northern region, this is something that our law enforcement brought forward. We have two regulations on Willard Bay, one on Willard Bay proper, and then one on the inlet, which is down along the South Marina. And what we'd like to do is remove the closure and then just have the limits be the same. This would simplify things for our law enforcement folks down there and make it easier for anglers to understand where they're at and what they need to do to follow the rule. And then the Blacksmith Fork, our northern region folks worked extensively with the Cache Valley anglers. And there's a water, the Blacksmith Fork River in Cache County, and it actually is overpopulated with brown trout. And we are working today, actually, which is where our northern region manager is today, on getting some population estimates there. And what this is just an allowance to double the limit on brown trout and then protect just one larger fish, which was kind of the concession for working with that group. And so the limit would be 8 brown trout with only 1 over 15. The Weber River, there's a small population, about 500 fish in this stretch of the Weber River cutthroat, native cutthroat, and they're rather large fish. And what they do is they contribute when they go up to reproduce in those tribs to population, subpopulations of smaller fish. And right now they're counted as part of your regular limit. What we'd like to do is protect those so that, you know, we can have that population, which is a really, you know, really great thing. And so the limit would be all cutthroat trout must be immediately released. And then Holmes Creek Reservoir, this is a kind of a community fishery up in Layton, and the largemouth bass in there, because of the immense pressure, angler pressure that's exhibited on that lake, this would just protect those, some of those fish in there, and allow some harvest, but allow some to, the over 12, which are the spawners, to be able to reproduce and provide additional fish, you know, for anglers in the future, so we don't have to manage it quite so tightly. Deer Valley Lakes, this is a highly used lake down in Central Region. And we'd like to, right now it has a series of special regulations on it. We'd like to just remove those special regulations and reduce the limit to 2 fish. Blue Lake, we have some spearfishing interests down there, or out there. It's a lake just south of Wendover. And right now it's been used as a dive site for training and for recreation out there for years. Within the last 2 or 3 years, we've had an interest in spearfishing for tilapia. And tilapia are illegally introduced. We don't manage them, don't want to manage them, don't want them there. And so if the spear fishermen wanted to go out and take some, by all means, please do. And so that's what we're recommending. And then the Utah Lake, this goes with the nighttime bow fishing, which statewide you could do it. In Utah Lake, we have some endangered species, the June sucker. And we work closely with the Fish and Wildlife Service and to get their recommendation for what they would accept as a regulation to take carp but not impact June sucker. And so this closure is what they recommended and we agree with. It's during, basically covers the spawn of the June sucker in the tribs of Utah Lake. So bow fishing at night would be illegal from May 1st through the second Saturday in July. In Green River, these are illegally introduced, the northern pike there, and you know we have that limit that we've been, you know, here every year doing. It's a catch and kill and a no limit. These fish actually come from the Yampa River in Colorado. And so what we'd like to do is implement that regulation, no limit and catch and kill. Walleye, same thing. They're illegally introduced into Red Fleet. Those fish are now in the Green River. And so we'd like to have a catch and kill on northern pike. This last no limit on channel catfish in the Green River is just because there's too many of them. They're stunted. They're really not large enough to really achieve good angler satisfaction. And so what we'd like to do is hopefully encourage people to go out and take as many as they can, allow those fish to grow a little bit larger so they are more attractive, and that becomes more of a good fishery so it attracts anglers. The Vernal Game Far Ponds, this is a brand new community fishery. It's the first real community fishery in the Northeast region. And as all community fisheries, we're recommending that 2 fish limit regardless of species. The Boulder Mountain Lakes, this is just really bookkeeping and wording. As you know, I know Karpowitz knows, this has been just complicated and without actually being from Garfield and Wayne County or being from Boulder Mountain, you couldn't really figure out by reading our rule where you were and whether you're in the Boulder Mountain Lakes or not. And so what we did is we worded this much the same as our hunt boundaries. It's basically a series of roads that creates a boundary around the Boulder Mountain Lakes, and it makes it easier to read. There are a few changes to that. There's 2, Cooks and Miller. There's angler interest in ice fishing those, and you know, it's one of those that if there's angler interest in you know, in ice fishing in those waters, we want to add them to that list. So we're recommending that Cooks and Miller are open year-round. The East Fork of Boulder Creek, this we treated 2 years ago. We're still waiting to be able to treat that the second time so we could reintroduce cutthroat down there. There are some residual brook trout, not very many, but if someone catches some or one, we don't want to have a regulation that looks like that we're protecting them, since we want them gone anyway. And so we implemented that bonus brook trout limits, which we have in a number of other waters. Fish Lake, this is really just a simplification. Before, we had a regulation that was specific to splake and lake trout down there. And what this is just a limit of four trout, and only one may be over 28 inches, regardless of species. And really, that just targets those fish without actually saying it. But if they catch a rather large rainbow or other species, then that would count within that limit. Salina City Pond, this is a new community fishery. And as such, you know, we'd have that community fishery, the two fish, regardless of species limit on it. All right, that's the end of our recommendations. What I'd like to do is just walk you guys quickly through the process that we've undertaken last year, and then kind of augmented this year and put a little bit more effort into it. We did a statewide survey, and I'll go over that in a minute. It was an online survey, and just trying to, it's not scientific by any means, but it's just to solicit public input so we can tell what anglers are thinking and what they're you know, happy with and what they're not. We also encouraged them to hard mail us. We had a number of open houses per region where people could just come in and discuss things with the local DWR personnel and encourage them to say what was on their mind without having any real agenda. We also solicited email, which we had a number of. People dropped in. We had a number of phone calls through the year, and then the internet forums. We had input from there as well. So the survey, we left it open for just over a month, and we had 1,367 people participate in that survey. There were seven questions that were related to, you know, recommendations or proposals, and then there was one question that was just a free-form question to allow people just to give us feedback on whatever was on their mind. All of the specific recommendations were overwhelmingly supported, except for this Forsyth Reservoir proposal, which was an illegal perch introduction. We offered a number of management alternatives. One would be a no-limit catch and kill. One would be a no-possession, so you couldn't take perch home if you did catch one. And then the last would be a reservoir closure. And what we wanted to do was just gauge how people would react to that. They were adamantly opposed to reservoir closure and no-possession. The reason being is they feel like they could impact perch by going out there and harvesting them, and which led us to believe that we need to do some additional education in having people understand what that catch and kill is for. It's a message. It's not that we expect or people can go out and expect to remove all of the perch or all of the walleye that were illegally introduced. It's just impossible biologically. But it is a message that we're not going to manage them. They oppose that, and we just need to do a better job and educate folks about illegal introductions and what those management recommendations are for and what their purpose is. We had 746 write-in comments in that last question, and, you know, interestingly enough, almost half of the comments wanted more strict regulations, and the other half wanted more liberal regulations, which, you know, you could either take to mean that we're right on target or we're so far off that no one agrees with us. So, you know, I'll leave that up to you guys to decide. The only areas of agreement were we need more law enforcement presence everywhere, and they loved the community fisheries program and wanted more community fisheries. And then stream access kept coming up, and, you know, they just wanted to assure that they would have stream access and it wouldn't be taken from them. Okay, one of the questions that we asked was just Utah Lake specific on the statewide survey, and it was split even. 50% of the people would support a change and 50% of the people were opposed. And so we followed up with another survey just specific to Utah Lake. And we had, this was just two anglers that we could pull out that had bought their license online that fished at Utah Lake. And so we had 685 comments. And like the statewide survey, you know, it was the same thing. Half wanted more strict regulations, half wanted more relaxed regulations. But we kind of honed in on just who the bass fishermen were on Utah Lake. And, you know, and I'll get to that next slide. The other issues were the same, kind of same theme, at least, as a statewide. They wanted the carp removal program to continue. Law enforcement was an issue. And they wanted more access around Utah Lake. So very similar to the statewide. As a result of what we found out on the Utah Lake survey, just as a bass fisherman, we need to just do more work in educating the public and with the central region, getting better information on Utah Lake, the population of the bass and where it's at. And then we need to work more closely with the public and have them understand the relationship between regulations and populations. That is all. I'll take any questions.
I just have one real quick question. Right back at the very beginning, you were talking about the two-rig, three-rig situation, and you said something that I may have misunderstood. You said you have three-rig units in your tackle box, and if you go to a two-rig unit lake, are you in violation if you have those in possession or only if you use them?
That's a good question. I don't know. I honestly don't know. I know that I have them in my tackle box and I carry them around. I do use them at Lake Powell, but, you know, they are in my possession.
Mike, you might want to talk to Drew after.
I might.
I was going to ask Mike if he needs to make an arrest or what we need to do here.
But there would be confusion in, at any event if that were to come up. So
yes,
that would be another reason maybe to
I might
change.
Be arrested today. So.
I was going to say it's probably good if you don't leave the room for
it wasn't
a while.
Designed, the question wasn't designed to get you in trouble, but it was designed to see if there was confusion that might be eliminated by along those lines.
Ernie?
Yeah, Drew, how about a quick update on the Utah Lake carp removal program in terms of how well it's doing and finding a funding offset?
I think Mike Slater could answer that, if no one else. Mike?
Come to the mic, if you would.
No, I'm happy to say that it's going very well. We have one person, one of our biologists, is out there with the Loy Fishery Company on a weekly basis, monitoring what we're seeing, what we're catching, both bycatch as well as the carp. They're doing well. We're looking forward to the ice fishing season. They actually catch a lot more carp through the ice than they do in the open water. What else could I say about... the market for the carp. It's a perennial issue. We're still addressing that. We've got Director Steiler involved. We've got a group together trying to investigate what are some opportunities to get others involved in funding this program and ultimately marketing the carp themselves. And rather than it being the Fish and Wildlife Service, the Division of Wildlife, people like that, just the agencies trying to utilize these fish, we feel that there's people like Utah County, the businesses, the people that are associated really closely with Utah Lake, they have something to gain with the removal of the carp. Ultimately, it could be a cleaner, it could be a prettier, it could be a nicer lake when it's all said and done. Those kind of individuals or entities can benefit from such a result. And so there is a process that we're going through right now, trying to investigate that to see if that's a way that we could utilize some money from some other sources to ultimately provide some kind of facility right there on the lake to process those fish. We want to use those fish, whether it be for feed, even for the state of Utah, possibly to use for our hatchery systems. There is some fish mill, some opportunities there, which would be kind of a good thing to be able to show that we're removing something, but then the same agency or the state is actually benefiting from that rather than having to go out to another source and purchase those kind of feeds.
just an idea, and that's what we're looking at. And that's kind of the roads that we're going down right now.
Any other questions from the board? Go to questions in Iraq. Before we do, Bruce, we welcome you aboard. You're substituting.
Thank you. I'll just give you a quick summary of what the RAC went through.
Okay.
Two proposals, the review and acceptance of the minutes, that was unanimous. The fishing guidebook and the rule that we just discussed, that was passed unanimously. The only question that came up was a question about ice fishing at Duck Creek, and that's something we're going – right now it's not legal because the DOT had asked us to not do that because they had a parking problem, but that's – I think the situation has kind of changed down there, and we're going to look into it, and I think we'll probably work towards getting that opened up, hopefully maybe this winter. And we had an informational item on Monroe Mountain Working Group, and that was it.
Thank you. Dearest?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Southeast region failed to have a quorum present, so we were unable to have any votes on any issues. We did listen to the presentation by Drew and discussed with the RAC that was present there, and but again, no votes were taken.
Thank you, Fred. The Central.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We had two motions in the Central region. The first, to accept this fishing guidebook and rule as presented, and that passed unanimously. We also had a second motion having to do with wheelchair-bound boots groups and crossbow fishing. And the motion was to ask the appropriate division personnel to meet with these groups and formulate a plan, see how the rule fit, and that passed unanimously.
Thank you. Boyd, thanks for helping us out.
In the Northeast region, we had two motions. The first motion was to accept as presented, but to add a two-day possession limit. That motion failed 2-4, and the subsequent motion was to accept as presented, and that passed unanimously. So,
okay. And Robert from the Northern region.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. After some discussion on the disposal method, we did have a motion to recommend the Wildlife Board approve the fishing guidebook and rule R657-13 as presented, with an opportunity to comment on the disposal method once it's determined.
Thank you. I jumped ahead. Is there anybody in the audience that has a question, not a comment, but a question for Drew? If not, we'll go to our comment cards.
Got one.
Okay, sorry. On fishing?
Yes. Hi, Dale. James Gilson from Castledale. As much as I'd like to put Justin Hart on the spot and get his heart pumping a little bit, I'll ask the questions of Drew. Would you kind of give the board a review of the discussion in Iraq about the Joes Valley closure and maybe what the division feels about that being opened in the next proclamation for next year?
Well, as you know, we implemented a tiger muskie program in Joes Valley. I think this is the third year, and it's doing quite well. The anglers find it now a popular place to be. Those tiger muskie are approaching 40 inches, and the splake fishermen that were going to Joes Valley are now converted tiger muskie fishermen. There was probably six people that showed up at the Southeast Region RAC, and they all had a similar comment, which we discussed. The comment was to remove the closure that was for splake fishermen on Joes Valley in the fall, to extend the opportunity for tiger muskie fishermen to go up and fish in the fall for those fish. And we talked as you know, Justin and I, and about that from a biological standpoint, and biologically we support it. At the time, the comment I made is that it hasn't gone through the public process, and you know, we feel strongly about letting the anglers as a whole address things through the public process and let them know, let us know, their likes and dislikes, and really get a statewide perspective about things. So what we offered up was to let it go to the next rack cycle, or if we have to take it out again, and do it at that time, and just allow it to go through the survey and the Racks and Wildlife Board next year.
One more question: are there any other lakes that are closed for that same season to protect Splake in the state, and have there been?
I believe there's portions of reservoirs that are closed. The one that comes to mind is the Flaming Gorge. It has a closure on Linwood Bay for lake trout. Nighttime closure. Other than that, I can't think of any.
Thank you. Okay. Other questions? I'll go to comments. I have several comment cards. There's anybody else that wants to comment, if you fill out one of these cards, get them to Stacy over here. If you're representing the group, we'll give you 5 minutes. If you're representing yourself, we'll give you 3 minutes. And I'm going to stick. Wait, let's see. You know what? Before I do that, it's 10:30. What do you say we take a 10-minute break? We'll come back in 10 minutes. Thank you. We need to move right along.
I've been very impressed with it.
Sorry, can't help.
No, I understand.
We're to the point to where we're going to take comment from the audience. As you come forward, if you will, state your name. And you've got 3 minutes. Our first comment card is Ken Strong, if you'll come forward, Ken.
Ken Strong, representing myself. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to address you guys at this time, and I'd like to congratulate Jim on his retirement, and good luck in the future, and thanks for the wonderful things you've done for the state of Utah. I would like to talk to you a minute about fish limits. I'll talk basically about trout, because that is basically the smallest limit we have in the state of Utah. Right now, if you catch a limit of fish, you either have to bottle them, smoke them, or consume them, eat them, until then they remain on your limit. We used to have a limit of 10 fish, then we lowered it down. We've come down 60% down to 4 fish as a limit. My concern is anybody that bottles fish, they're either doing 4 at a time or they're breaking the law by stockpiling. I've gone through and looked at some of the different things, and for instance, in Idaho, the law reads that the number of fish that may be legally harvested by one person a day is the bag limit, and the bag limit possession limit is the maximum number of fish that may be in a possession of a person while that person is in the field or while he is transporting the fish for consumption or storage. So once they hit the house, they're no longer considered part of the limit. In Utah, we have, for instance, on pheasants and grouse and other birds, we have 2 the first day. We can shoot 2 more the second day and have 4 in possession. And after the third day, we can have 6 in possession. My proposal is that we change the possession limit to where we can either have several possessions in our freezer so that we can have fish throughout the year, or if we make it so that once we reach our home destination, they are no longer on our limit if you've processed them in some other way, whether it be to fillet them out and freeze them or whatever. But anyway, that's my proposal, and I hope you'll think about it. Thanks much.
Thank you. Next is Paul Drummond.
I'm Paul Drummond, chairman of the Utah Anglers Coalition. We, too, would like to thank Director Karpowitz. He's done an excellent job supporting us, as well as the whole angling community. We have had the opportunity to meet with the Division Aquatics personnel and fully support all the regulations. We do have a couple comments pretty much in line with them. One is that there be no changes to the largemouth bass regulations or perch regulations, bass regulations at Utah Lake and perch regulations at Forsyth Reservoir until there's a lot more study done of the issues and get more clarification. The other issue is, and again we support them, our position is that their harvest of yellow perch as a means of population control is an ineffective management strategy. So we very much support and appreciate the work done by the aquatics people. Thank you.
Thank you. Next on board, Terry Reist, is it? Reist?
Good morning. My name is Terry Reist. I'm with the represent Utah Spearfishing Association. Thank you for this time and opportunity. Just having moved to the state a few months ago, I've had a little chance to attend any of the RAC meetings, which is why I'm speaking today. I'm a sportsman, and I love to hunt and fish. And I spend a good amount of time doing this with my family and my kids. And whether I'm out spearfishing or rod and reel fishing, the happiness and the joy and the enjoyment we get from this, it's the same. There's no difference. Every hunter and fisherman uses their knowledge of animal behavior to improve their chances of bringing home meat to their family. During the blueing olive hatch, for example, fly fishermen use this knowledge to their advantage. Ice off at strawberry for cutthroats, it's the same thing. I'm trying to say that I love the outdoors and really appreciate wildlife resource management to help preserve and maintain an activity and way of life for me and my family for years and years to come. But the current spearfishing limitations to only fish from June to November are restrictive. The September cutoff for Fish Lake is even more so. There are bag and possession limits for all waters in Utah, and I'm not sure why those rules, which apply to line fishermen, do not also apply to spear fishermen. There is a spawn in and around September for lake trout in Fish Lake. Line fishermen know this, and you know that they use this to their advantage to help improve their chances of taking something home. I believe that there's a misconception, false perceptions, that spearfishing is easy. If it were easy, there'd be a lot more spearfishermen in this state than there currently are. If it truly was easy, there'd be a lot more spearfishermen in this state than there would be line fishermen. Let me catch up here. If limits need to be in place, they should apply to everyone. If limitations on lake trout exist, they should apply across the board. You cannot discriminate against a group because someone who doesn't participate in that sport or doesn't understand it thinks it's an unfair advantage. I'm asking this board that makes decisions for fish and game laws to base their decisions on facts and biology, not hearsay, not emotions, and not on perhaps flipping comments made by feuding parties like in the past. Spearfishermen are no different from anyone else. We want appropriate and logical game management to preserve our valuable natural resources. All waters should be open to all legal forms of take, and bag possession and seasonal quotas should be in place, and these should be managed and used and applied to everyone equally. Through the ages, spearfishing has been one of the most, if not the most, sustainable forms of fishing that man has ever known. Several comments were made today about adding 90,000 line fishermen to the Utah records. Spearfishermen won't come anywhere near to that. If we're lucky, we might add 50 spear fishermen in a year. and some of the methods of take that were discussed, the number of hooks on a line, it seems that that is to promote or increase the chance of success while fishing, and yet the rules for spearfishing remain very, very limited and restrictive and not equal and unfair. That's all I have to say today. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, Clifford Sackett.
I'd like to thank you for the privilege of coming up here. Anyway, to get to the point, I know that a lot of people like to keep fish. People like to keep bass in particular, and that's all I want to talk about. But the limits on bass right now is you can keep so many under 12 inches and only one over. And that's the way it is on some of the lakes. You've got other lakes where you can keep different numbers of fish, and in a lot of ways it's quite confusing to a lot of people that haven't fished for bass before. One of the simpler methods of doing it, and a lot of other states has adopted the same rules, and here in Utah we have rules like this for trout, which is a slot limit where from a certain size to a certain size must be released. That's to protect the species and also to put more fish in a lake for everybody to have fun catching and releasing, and some people still have room for keeping. With the bass, nobody really likes catching a lot of 10, 11-inch bass. I mean, 10, 11-inch fish, no matter what size they are, for the most part, unless you're talking about perch or bluegill, it gets kind of boring after a while. And there's not very much meat on them for people that want to take them home. But if you have, like, say, a 14 to a 20-inch bass size limit, where they can keep one over 20 and fill up the rest of their limit or have a full limit under that size, that makes it a little more convenient and everything else for everybody else. And if the state could adopt basically this rule throughout the entire state, with the exception of probably Lake Powell and Flaming Gorge, that would simplify matters a lot for the law enforcement. It will give the people able to keep more fish and a bigger size of fish, and also help the people that want to do catch and release. Thank you.
Thank you. James Gilson.
Thanks again, James Gilson from Castledale. Just would like to ask the board to consider a change for the proclamation for 2013 and return Joe's Valley year-round fishing. It's been closed. It started closed today. It'll be closed for about 6 weeks, and we're hoping that that might change this year, but where it was in proclamation, we knew that was pretty impossible, unless Jim wants to go out with a big bang. But anyway, if we have to wait a year, it's there's no biological reason, there's no no more protection, there's no other fishery in the state that's been protected, and it's debatable whether it was necessary in the first place. There was some illegal fishing stuff that also prompted this. So we're asking not to have to wait. But we can't fish for 6 weeks now, and if we don't put it in proclamation, come this time next year, we won't be able to fish again. We just wanted to clear up a couple things on them letters. I read through them. They were delivered to me last night. Another guy that was interested in this wanted to let you hear from the businesses. There's some miscommunications in them letters, but they all say that it's important to their businesses, and they'd like to see this return to open as well. And so we'd like to have you consider that, and we can. There's been $10,000 worth of conservation money put into those fish two different times. One of the businesses that's wrote you a letter has donated $500 twice to help this fishery happen. Another business in there probably does $3,000 to $5,000 a year with conservation groups, and they'd like to see some benefits from this fishery, and we'd like to get to fish it. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. George Summer.
I'm George Summer, and I'm representing the Utah Bass Federation. And I'd first like to thank Jim for his years of service and helping hunters and anglers in the state of Utah. And we're going to miss you, Jim. I'd like to go on record as saying the Utah Bass Federation is opposed to liberalizing any liberalization or season changes for underwater spearfishing. Utah currently allows more fish to be harvested with spearfishing than any of our surrounding states. In addition, we allow harvest on more waters than any other state, any of our neighbors. And none of the other states are increasing their opportunities for spearfishing. Our intention is to take this to the RACs and the Wildlife Board next year to address and review the current regulations to, address the conflicts that we're having with hook and line anglers. We've been getting numerous complaints about issues with spearfishing, and we intend to address that next year at the RAC process. And I do want to make one comment on this. I'll be real quick. But spearfishing, it's difficult to compare spearfishing to hook and line angling in that spearfishing is more like hunting. So once that spear is released and that fish is shot, it's done. With hook and line angling, we can choose to keep or release that fish. And I think that's the main difference, and that's one of the challenges that we're facing with spearfishing in the state of Utah. Thank you.
Thank you, George. Dan Smith.
Hi, I'm Dan Smith. I work at Fish Check Outfitters here in Salt Lake City. We're a fishing tackle store. We get a lot of comments about spearfishing, and we've heard a lot of people say down in Fish Lake that they find fish, the mackinaws, laying on the bottom, and the fishermen are trying to get records, so they'll shoot a fish. Well, fish look bigger underwater, so they'll measure it. It's not a record, so they'll go find another one. Well, we were talking, and our consensus is eliminate the records. If there's going to be spearfishing, eliminate the records. That way they're not looking for a record. They won't waste game. And I'm not saying they all do. I mean, there's bad anglers that do that too. But it just doesn't look right. We were up at Starvation Reservoir in September fishing the Walleye Classic on pre-fish. Me and my partner was going one direction and another team was coming the other way. And the guy's name was Kevin Lund. He said, did you see that fish back on the, behind the boat on top of the water? It was about an 8-pound walleye. And I said, no, we haven't. So we went down there and looked at it. And sure enough, it had been dead for a couple of days and it had a spear hole right through the center of it. Once you shoot, like George says, once you shoot a fish, you can't let it go, where we can. It takes it takes about 5 years for a bass at Deer Creek to become 12 inches and become fertile to spawn. So these spear fishermen are going out and shooting the bigger fish. Now you're getting rid of that gene pool. It's like the deer gene pool. It's like any other animal. Once you have that gene pool in that system, you don't want to get rid of that gene pool. That's what grows big fish. And as a tackle store, we're worried that we're going to start losing customers and people are going to start not fishing because the big fish are getting taken out and the gene pool is going away. So all we have is little fish. And that's our concern. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That's the last comment card that I have. You talk. You forgot?
It'd be the first time that I had time left, but I'm sorry. Did y'all receive the letter from the Emery County Public Lands Council supporting?
I did.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure they voted unanimous to open it as well. So I just want to make sure. Thanks.
Okay, comments. Well, let's regarding the fish proclamation. Let me just say, summarize what the RACs have done. Southern, Northeast, and Central region have unanimously supported the DWR presentation. The Central region also included a reference and support for handicapped individuals in a wheelchair with bow fishing. And the Northern region comment about the disposal method, and then that was passed unanimously. So pretty close unanimous across the state to support the DWR with reference to some tweaking. Do we have comments from the RAC then, or the board? Any comment? Yeah.
I got some questions, if that's all right. Can somebody tell me how many spear fishermen there are in the state? Do you have to have a...
I have a comment on that. I'm Josh Thornton from Dive Addicts. We sell probably more spear fishing equipment than anyone else in the state. If I had to guess, judge from the last 4 or 5 years or so, I'd say there's somewhere, we've dealt with somewhere around, somewhere between 100 and 200 is all. And I know for a fact that we sell more than anyone else in the state.
Okay. Thank you. And you can spear fish off just your fishing license. You don't have to.
Correct.
One more question on the Joes Valley situation. So if we don't take action on Joes Valley today, next year at this time, it'll still be closed?
I was going to say, is there not any way to revisit this when there's been time for some more public input? I know I was at the meeting, and it was great to see the number of anglers there from the Emery County area. There were... they were the only ones in the audience, really, that were there, besides a couple of students that I had there by assignment. So we had six or eight there, and they were all very much in favor of this issue. But, you know, there really wasn't any chance for anybody, if there was anybody, to express any kind of opposition or any kind of concerns or to see what the impacts might be otherwise. So I'm just curious if there is a chance to bring this back in a more formal way during the course of the upcoming RACs. And, you know, it may not make it into the guidebook, that's for sure, but certainly there are ways to make changes without having to make a snap decision.
Ernie.
I'll try a motion on this. I'd like to ask the DWR to consider removing the fall closure on Joes Valley, either by running it through a RAC meeting in the near future or no later than next year. After they've had time to adequately consider it, and then to get it through the full RAC board process. And that would be an action log.
Just a comment on that. If we approve the guidebook today, it'll be in print that it's open or that it's closed. And there's not going to be an opportunity between now and then for a RAC board process. So it's going to be in print. And if the board decided to go with a fall opening, we'd have to handle it through the media and through signage, but it will be in print that it's open or that it's closed.
Yeah, to respond, I'm recognizing that, but this would allow both going through the full public process at some point earlier, hopefully, and would also mean that it would not take 2 years to get implemented.
Yeah, it's possible. We do get complaints when we do that sort of thing that, well, I read in your guidebook that it was closed, so I didn't bother going, and then I found out everybody rushed up there and went fishing. So it does create that issue, but it is possible. You know, you could run it through the public process next spring or summer, and if the board decided that it should be open in the fall, then or closed in the fall, open in the fall, right? Then we could deal with it through it, even though it's in print that it's closed.
Look at it this way, Jim. It'll be somebody else's problem.
Jake?
So you're saying you would leave it open for this year?
I would leave it closed this year because I think it's a pretty significant change.
Okay.
And
then go through an action log.
You've got a chance to listen to it, not just have it rammed through.
Right. Well, I don't have any problems with it being open, but I'm just, I've not heard anything from the division yet as to the biological reason to do it or not to do it. And so maybe there's a good reason not to do it. Maybe there's a good reason to do it. But I haven't heard that. It's not been formally presented to anyone yet. And that's, we're supposed to make our decisions based on public input, but also biological information from the division. So I would be hesitant to make any kind of decision without the division's take on this, and we haven't heard a formal proposal from them. So
let me ask a couple people to respond. Darris, I know you it's a bad time not to have a quorum.
I'll say.
Pass that back to the rack. They let the Southeast region down right there.
They did.
Could you give us a little bit of feedback right there?
That's probably the most interest we've ever had in the Southeast region on a fishing proclamation or guidebook. Southeast region is probably not the premier area for fishing in Utah, but we do have a few waters, and these individuals were very passionate about Joes Valley, and I think a lot of it stems from the addition of muskies into Joes Valley, and fall is the best time to be fishing for these muskies, and all of a sudden they realized that their hands were tied. The other thing that's happening in the Southeast region is we lost a big fishery in Huntington Canyon due to the Sealy fire. We had a die-off at Lower Fish Creek because of the shutoff at Schofield Dam. And I think people are kind of scrambling for places to maybe spread out and do some fishing. Joes Valley has definitely turned into a trophy fishery, and it's going to get more and more popular as time goes on and people learn about the big splake and the big muskies in there. And I think the fact that we're looking 2 years down the road if we go through the normal process before any changes can be implemented, if that's the right thing to do, is probably the kicker. If there is a way to handle it so that we're looking at only one more year of closure instead of two more years of closure, I think it's palatable. I think the anglers in Emory County understand that nothing can be done this year. But I think they're going to be pretty disappointed if we go one more fall and not see something at least addressed That's my take of it. And the RAC members that were present at the meeting were very supportive of the anglers at the meeting.
Hey,
could
thank
I
you.
Say one thing, Mr. Chairman? I don't like that we are making a decision now, and there's going to be two, this closure, and then the next closure. I mean, we're talking months and months away before we could open that up if we don't take action now. I understand the public process and the importance of running things through the public process. On this particular issue, I wouldn't have a problem whatsoever if leaving it closed for this one, but open it up for next year, even if we say it's on an experimental basis and see how it goes and gather information and input on people's experience and what happens and go from there. I don't like the idea of leaving it. You know, we have it where the closure starts now and goes for weeks. I don't have a problem, and I think this board's been very good to respect the public process, and on this issue it wouldn't bother me at all to go ahead and open it up for next fall.
Yeah,
Director,
I think you better hear from our folks if there are biological considerations.
Drew, you're my next man. You're gonna give us the biology of this.
I talked to Justin Hart about this extensively. He's our Southeast Region Manager, and I just asked him about, you know, his preference of what he would rather see done, you know, opening it up experimentally or just opening it. Frankly, you know, like Dara said, there were more people there at the Southeast Region RAC than we've ever had, and, you know, biologically, we don't believe that there is an issue. The rule was really put in place probably because of public perception of what was going on there, more so than the impact of the fishery. And Justin just indicated that he'd rather, if you're going to open it, because in a year from now when it does go through the public process, that would be our preference anyway. It's just that we haven't heard from those people that may oppose this, and that's the fear, you know. And that was the thing that I did say at the Southeast Region RAC. You know, we don't know if there's a segment of the population that might oppose this. We just don't know. Chances are there's not, but you don't know.
So biologically, it would not be detrimental to the population, the fish population, to open it.
No.
Thank you. We might come back to you. Ernie?
With the division support indicated, this could go out in the November RAC meetings, which will start very shortly, being handled by the regional fisheries person, would probably get full approval from RACs, I believe, and would come to the board for a vote in December.
There's only one drawback to that, and that is, you know, the actual printing of the guidebook. That's the only.
However, we've got multiple corrections posted to multiple guidebooks on the internet today for this year's regulations. So it's not the end of the world to have a correction. And this one would spread like wildfire.
Right.
I admit that the public support and participation was much greater than it was at the meeting the year before. I was also at the meeting the year before when we talked about fisheries. And besides the division personnel that were at the meeting and the RAC personnel, there was myself and Tom Ogden, who's on the Blue Ribbon Fisheries Committee. And so to have eight people there instead of two was a big improvement. And again, my concern, you know, a few minutes ago, we had a big discussion about doing something immediately without going through a process and following the plans that we have in place as far as cougar management goes. And we sent the houndsmen home probably a little bit discouraged because we didn't take any action for them at this meeting. And you know, maybe it's a little bit different situation, but I'm a little bit leery of not having any public input, even though I would support opening the lake to fishing.
Okay, Director.
Well, I was just going to say, I heard Drew say there's no biological concern. You're not taking away anyone's opportunity. You're expanding it. You've heard Dara say that the public has voiced support. The fishing regulations were on the agenda, although that specific proposal was not. I think that's quite different than what happened with the Houndsman.
Very much so.
The Houndsman, the guidebook is in print. It's problematic to, you'd not only have to change the guidebook, but the plan to do everything they wanted. I see this as an expansion of opportunity, not a limiting of it. And I don't think it'd be a huge problem for the board to approve that for next year. Now, if you're going to do something this year, that would be problematic because the guidebook is in print. And I'm nervous about printing the guidebook and then doing a process to change the guidebook. So I don't think the board would be way out of line to expand some fishing opportunity if there's no biological concern.
Thank you, Jim, because that's what I was just going to get to by asking Darius to comment and Drew to comment. We got the biology and we got the public, and there does not appear to be conflict in the problem. And as Director Karpowitz said, it's just an additional opportunity, particularly in the Southeast, that doesn't have that many opportunities. Now, I'm not a can't vote unless you guys throw up a tie.
I think we've had a good discussion. I appreciate the input from the division and from Darius. Darius, we need to get on your RAC members down there. That's kind of stifles the system. And I know.
Baseball bat.
Mr. Chairman, I would make the motion that that the Joes Valley fishery, that we open that up for the 2013 season, that the closure stay in place now, that's in print, but for next year we go ahead and open that up.
Did Ernie, did you have a motion, or were you just talking?
Yeah, I did, but it hasn't been seconded. I'll withdraw that motion based on the later discussion.
I'll second John's motion.
Okay, a motion by John, seconded by Jake, that we open up Joes Valley to fishing beginning our next guidebook year. All in favor? Any opposed?
I'm going to vote no, and it's not because I don't want to see fishing in the fall in Joes Valley. I think that'll be great, and hopefully someday I'll be able to catch a tiger muskie over there myself when I get smart enough to figure out how to do that. But I just feel like the public process is very important, and I would, that's the basis for my no vote. I don't have any problems with what we're doing other than we're circumventing the process.
Okay. So let me summarize that vote. Was 3-4 and 1 against? Okay, so we'll pass on.
Yeah, I sympathize with Mike. I was really ripped on that because I intensely dislike what we've just done. But I decided to go ahead and vote aye.
I would agree with what both of them have said, and if there was any kind of concerns brought up by the RAC or by our division personnel, I wouldn't have made the motion, but I feel pretty good about this one. So
yeah, and I agree with John also on it, and it actually did go through the public process.
It did.
Those people actually made their concerns made to the RAC and to the Wildlife Board, or they wouldn't have been there.
Not only the people, we've received several letters regarding that.
And if we're moving on to a new subject, if you would, Mr. Chairman, I would make a motion that we ask Bruce Bonebreak in the southern region to address the Duck Creek issue for ice fishing on the lake and working with UDOT and others for access. Have that presented to us at, a year from now.
Okay.
Action log.
So it's an action log item on the Duck Creek. Second that. Seconded by Ernie. We'll put that on the action log for Bruce or Southern Region to come back after working with UDOT and whatever on that parking and see where we're at.
We'd be glad to do that. We've already got the wheels in motion, actually, so thank you.
Thank you.
Can I, on the spear fishing, I don't, there's something about.
John?
Yes, sir.
Let's take a vote on that action log.
Sorry. I thought it was a done deal.
Well.
I can't imagine anybody would vote against Jake, so.
Officially. All in favor of putting that Duck Creek fishing on the action log? Unanimous then? Okay, go ahead, John.
All right.
Excuse me.
Sorry about that. On the spear fishing, I can't imagine that we have enough spear fishermen in this state to have any kind of an adverse effect on anybody's business. Fishing is huge in Utah, and I can't imagine that we have enough spear fishermen to affect population of walleye or lake trout or anything like that. Drew, am I out of line? Am I wrong?
Yeah, you're wrong.
Am I?
Yeah.
Tell me how.
Well, just one thing. We worked with the spear fishermen 4 years ago and created a list of waters and species within those waters where we wanted them to take them. You know, we wanted to encourage harvest on those waters of those species of fish. We've talked to the spear fishermen at the Northeast Region RAC about revisiting that list. However, you know, there is a public perception here and a disagreement between 450,000 anglers and 100. And, you know, there's a lot of, the people who pay the bills really should be at least heard, you know, here more than 100.
Well, I understand that. So you're telling me 100 guys are affecting the fish population?
No, I'm saying that there's a real issue between the spear fishermen and the regular anglers, and they need to work together. And that's what I'm saying.
So I'm not wrong.
And John, no offense when I say you're wrong, but you wasn't here when we had the problems with the fish lake.
Okay.
And the spear fishing down there, and we had out-of-state people even from Colorado coming in there and spear fishing them big lake trout. So, that to me was a problem.
Okay.
And if I remember right, I voted for it initially, and when that problem rose and became what it was, I voted against that we close that so that they could not take those spawners out of that lake like that.
Ernie's jumping out of his chair over there.
So. I'd just like to echo what Dell has said and what Drew has said. I started spear fishing 52 years ago, but I sat through those votes and that discussion too. This one must go through a full public process and a huge discussion of all the anglers. And I won't vote for anything that gets done, you know, on a rapid basis.
That was going to be my question, is have there been, I mean, what kind of discussions and talks have taken place? Because, I mean, you got the bass fishermen, the spear fishermen, and I mean, I hate it when people come to the meetings and you got two groups of fishermen banging heads. It reminds me of the big game guys, and I don't like that.
Since this first came up, and it's been at least 3 years ago, we've encouraged the spear fishermen and the Utah Angler Coalition to just, you know, get in the same room and talk things out. They, I believe, you know, came to one meeting, and I really believe that they are part of our angling public, but they need to be part of the team and part, you know, just work together on things. I agree. I think it needs to go through the public process.
I think, Drew, in the Northeast region, that one individual there, he had his eyes opened after spending some time with you and talking.
He did. He's a good man, and his name is Mike Whelan out there. And what we told him is we would be happy to sit down with the spear fishermen and go over that list again. And we will. You know, the list was established working with those guys and our regional managers, and like George Summer said, it's a fairly liberal list compared to other states. And, you know, so would we review it? Sure. We'd sit down with them. There may be waters that we'd like to add. There may be waters on there that the spear fishermen would want to remove. But it just takes sitting in the same room and getting it done. And then we'd be back next year with a recommendation. One thing we are committed to is actually, you know, including this, and we had this idea after, you know, the number of inputs through the RAC process, is to actually ask the question in a survey. You know, we do that online survey to all of our anglers, and they are part of the angling groups, and you get an idea as to, you know, what we would gain and what we would lose in public opinion and support by changing such a regulation. I think that's a you know, good move as well.
So is there any planned talks then? I mean, you're planning on doing this survey, and how hard is it to get these two groups together?
We did it before. We can do it again. And this winter is a good time to do it.
Is this why Jim's retiring, because he knew this was on the agenda?
No, I think he just wants to go fishing.
Are you going spear fishing, Jim? Okay. I appreciate the information. I mean, I hate to see two groups of sportsmen and fishermen that don't see eye to eye. It's very disheartening to sit up here and see that kind of conflict. So
right, and you know, we work with both groups productively. We have before. You know, we'll continue to do that. You know, I have to say though that, you know, if you look at what regular fishing is, you know, a fish willingly takes a hook in the lip or in the mouth, and that fish, you know, 7 out of 10 times can be released alive. You know, you shoot a fish with a spear, and it's definitely not the same as a hook in the mouth. That's a one-time deal.
You're saying the survival rate goes down.
And yeah, well, yeah, yes, yeah. And you know, we actually talked to one spear fisherman about a tag system, which is something we ought to think about, you know, perhaps in the future, not now. But if this is truly a hunt, you know, there are some trophy fish out there that if you had a, you know, a conservation tag for a lake trout at Fish Lake for some odd number of dollars, maybe that's something to consider. You know, it's just something that it's more akin to hunting than it is to fishing.
Okay, thank you. There's several in the audience have been raising your hand, want to speak.
I'm good with the explanations I've been given. I don't have anything else to say.
We're following the program, so I'm not going to be able to call you back, as you've each had an opportunity to already speak. You're 3 or 5 minutes. Right now, we're just in the process of going through the board discussion prior to a motion, and the board's trying to get all the input they can from those professionals as well as from the public, and we've heard from the public. So at this point in time, board, tell me where we're at. Thank you. Ernie.
I've got one last topic I think we need to clean up before a general motion, and that is the use of crossbows by disabled persons on carp. And I would make a motion that we add to the action log a request that DWR take a proposal on disabled person use of crossbows on carp to the RACSN board.
And I believe the disabled rule is on the next agenda, right?
December. It's scheduled for the December RAC order.
So it could fit into that.
So we just ask them to add that to it then.
Okay.
I'd second that.
All right, so that's taken care of. Mike?
Are you going to, do you need to vote on, I seconded Ernie's.
Is that a motion? Proposal. We need to second that.
Okay, we've got a motion from Ernie to put that on the action log, although it's probably going to come up in December when we deal with a handicap. Mike has.
Does it need to go on the action log?
I don't know that it needs to. Ernie, does it?
It's okay. Leave it there. It's a good reminder.
Okay. It doesn't hurt. We can just put a short time limit on that action log. So, Mike, you've seconded that motion. We're motion to put it on the action log, recognizing that that's going to be a part of the handicap discussion in December. All in favor of that?
Aye.
No opposed? Okay, thank you. Next.
I had one more question that had to do with what Ken brought up. If I catch my limit and go home and put it in my freezer, then go catch more, am I in violation? Because I haven't fried them up yet.
That was a question I had, too. I was interested in that.
I don't like that.
I mean I don't either, and I don't see the point. What's the rationale behind that? I'm sure. I mean, I can guess, but
just as one example, there was a recent bust up in southern Davis County with a couple that had, I believe it was just over 1,000 trout in the freezer. Two of them.
Welcome to Alaska.
Maybe
those
that's
people
their
up there have
storage.
A whole freezer full, and it's all legally got.
Was there
maybe one of our guys ought to respond to the biological reason? For
yeah,
the
I don't.
Limit?
Really, it's just like you said, people. There are people around that will just take fish and keep taking them, and it's to prevent things like that. That's all. Other states have two-day possession limits. We don't. It's definitely something that that it came up in the northeast region RAC, and it's definitely worth considering.
Did back to this 1,000 fish in the freezer situation? I assume these folks were cited for having more than their possession limit. Was there any evidence that they had harvested them illegally? That they'd taken more than their limit at a given time?
It was actually at a community fishery in Murray, if I remember right. And I can't remember the exact number, but they would
take
their limit.
So they caught four fish a day for 250 days?
And just kept taking four. And they did have a freezer full, and it was pretty, hundreds.
But there is, I'm just around where I've been. The possession limit is most often something like 2 to 3 days bag limit.
Yeah, it is.
And I don't have a problem. I'd like to see it. I see the people, the campers up on Strawberry every holiday weekend, and there's 1,000 campers up there for a three-day weekend, and they've got four fish, and they got to go home or quit fishing or something.
Right.
That doesn't make sense. In fact, to me, to increase that possession limit seems to be a way to expand the opportunity and keep them excited. But we want to avoid what you're talking about, the 1,000 fish.
Right.
I can understand the thousands of fish being an issue. But like Ken said, if somebody bottles the fish or something like that, and, they're obviously using the fish, they haven't got around to cooking it up. I mean, that seems...
It's definitely something to consider. Other states, Idaho has a two-day possession limit. Oregon has a two-day possession limit. And they do on game birds as well. It creates a situation in their states where if you do go out for multiple days on a camping trip or an extended fishing trip, that you could have, a limit for each day that you were there. It's worth considering. Biologically, a lot of waters we need harvest. Lake Powell is one where people do go down for multiple days and it would probably fit the management in many of our waters.
Would it be appropriate to put that on the action log for next year, that we the next proclamation that we look into that and kind of weigh our options? Because that was kind of going to be my next comment. Was isn't that kind of counterproductive, where you're encouraging harvest?
It is.
On certain species, it seems like that's kind of working against us there.
I also think this is one of those things that needs to be on that online survey as well, and just try and gauge public, a public support of such a thing.
If you put that on the action log, you could go on in and do your online survey or whatever you wanted to do, and then report back to us.
Absolutely.
We'd do that. Time.
Absolutely.
So we'll go ahead and make that motion.
I'd make the motion that we put this issue on the action log. so that next year at this meeting we know whether we need to make some adjustments or whatnot.
So that next year we've got the biology going to the racks.
Give them a year to do their surveys and really look into, you know, is this working against us, where we're trying to encourage harvest and how we'd go about it and what the best options might be if we was going to make a change.
I'll second John's
motion. Okay. Motion made by John, seconded by Jake, to put this issue of the possession limit on the action log with it to come back up next year so it can go to the rack in a timely manner. All in favor? Unanimous. Thank you. Okay. Ernie, yes.
Just a clarification. Drew, would you please confirm that everything in the Fish and Wildlife Service recommendations, the letter, the revised letter that they sent us, is included in the division proposal?
It is.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Good job, Ernie. Okay, man. Director.
One more thing before you make a final motion. And this is a procedural question, and maybe to Ernie, because he's kind of the parliamentarian around here, but I'm still back on this Joe's Valley issue a little bit because I'm concerned that the Southeastern region did not vote on it. I sit on two or three other boards, and there is a process for ratification of board motions. I think the potential exists here for the board to ask the region to take that out at the next RAC meeting for ratification. If you're concerned that there's not been enough public input. What I don't know is what happens if the RAC refuses to ratify.
The answer to that would be in the director's emergency closure.
Okay. So if the board really thinks the public ought to weigh in on this, and based on the input they already have, it sounds like it's very likely they will ratify what the board did. The board could ask the region, when they have a quorum, to ratify this decision and take public input at that time. No, it's a local issue. I think if you did it just in the Southeastern region, you'd be, I don't know.
That was my question. Is it just a Southeastern region issue?
We have not done this much, and I hesitated to even mention it, but where two board members expressed a concern about lack of public comment, and the fact that the Southeastern region did not vote, it is, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Ernie, appropriate to ask the RAC to ratify and vote on that board decision.
Wasn't the month before the Southeastern ever had a quorum also?
Kind of assuming they'll be there.
No, this had one. The Northeast that traditionally doesn't have quorum.
This was the second meeting in a row, really.
And we voted on everything they did there also.
I thought they had someone come late. Oh, no, it was unofficial.
We thought we had a quorum, but in reality we didn't.
They did not
but have. But I'm just throwing it out there. I don't really find which way the board goes with it, but it is a motion where there was no vote from the region that the water sits in.
Okay. That's why we have half a dozen different minds up here. Everybody's got something to add. We appreciate all of it. So, and I agree with Director Karpowicz, we've had the public, what there was in favor of, the biologists. No reason not to, but we've made a motion, but I think that is a good point that we entertain a motion.
A couple of questions about that. Are you going to ask the board to ratify the board's decision, or are you going to ask them to ratify the proposal that was made? I don't think the RAC can ratify our decision.
Yeah, it's not really a ratification. It's a recommendation from the RAC to support the board decision, if you feel that strongly. It's not really a ratification.
Doesn't that still throw your schedule off on your guidebook?
I don't think so. You got a RAC meeting coming up right away, right?
I don't know what your guidebook's going to be printed, but the board's made a motion. If it's what?
And that
week from,
in price or in.
And that may just muddy the waters, and it may open a door that you don't want down the road. But you could ask the region to discuss it at their next RAC meeting, even if you didn't do it as a ratification or anything else, to get that public input on the record.
You know, we have the process of where people show up to the RAC meeting, and there wasn't enough people there to vote to say whether they wanted to do that one way or another. But to me, if there's no biological reason why we haven't changed anything according to Drew or whatever, if they don't have enough people there to vote, it looks to me like it's the Wildlife Board decision to make at this time to whether we move forward or whether we leave it the way it is.
I think you're probably right.
I would agree with Jake.
But because of the lack of a quorum in Iraq, what that really did is not support the public in that region. And the board is trying to go beyond that and support what the public input was, even though we did have a RAC. What Jim is suggesting is just some way of legitimizing or add an additional layer of support to that motion.
I think what Jake said made way more sense than what I said.
Well, in the public record, we already have minutes from the meeting, even though there wasn't a vote taken. There was input from the RAC members that were there, I think, that supported that. So, plus the public the input of the public that was there in support of
okay.
it. So,
let's let
not
that
like
die.
Nobody yeah. spoke if they, about it at all. Yeah.
And if they don't like it, there'll be another meeting next year where they can all show up and send us that recommendation. So,
okay. Thank you, board. I'm looking for any further discussion or motion. Jake?
I would move that we approve the fishing guidebook and rule R657-13 as presented by Drew with the other changes that we have made also. As presented.
Can we hear what those changes were one more time?
Well, we voted on every one of them.
It's
Valley. The only one was Joe's Valley. The others were action logs, right?
Okay.
Right.
All right.
Yeah, the only vote we took was Joe's Valley, and the rest we put on the action log with the spear fishermen and the sports fishermen. Well, they're both sports fishermen. Working together to try to come there. Okay, the motion's been made by Jake, seconded by
Ernie,
that we accept the balance of the DWR's presentation regarding fishing, recognizing that we've already made one motion. Those in favor of? Unanimous, 4-0. Okay. Yeah, can we get to your information and we'll move on?
Yeah, this is pretty short. So Mike Falks caught me. He said I am legal, that I have that in my tackle box, just so you know. Just so long as I don't use it, I'm good to go.
Good. I hate it when our employees get arrested.
Thanks for good social media, though.
All right.
How many up on the board have been arrested before?
This month or?
This is real short. This goes with these catch and kill things that we have going on, and that Forsyth. This is just the first jab at educating the public, starting with the board and RAC members and the people here at the Wildlife Board on this issue. What we're going to be talking about real briefly is just illegal species introductions. And there's one thing in common with all of these critters on this page, and that's that they were all introduced into Utah. Illegally. So Utah or illegal species introduction is probably the single biggest threat to the fisheries in Utah, and probably one of the largest issues facing the United States right now, and it is pandemic. It's destroying sport and native fisheries across the country. And what we need to do is just expend additional effort in education about this issue. So I'm not going to read these, but this is a list of waters that we knew when I first made this presentation a couple months ago, waters that experienced illegal introductions. Since then, this list has grown. This can't be something that is comprehensive because this action, this illegal species introduction, takes place faster than we can really add names to a PowerPoint presentation. This, again, is a list of species that have been introduced into Utah waters, and this, again, isn't comprehensive. Every time we go out, it seems like there's a new water and a new critter that was introduced. What you have here, though, is you have your sport fish that people move illegally. You have your bait fish that people move illegally. You have your aquarium fish and aquarium animals that people move illegally. There's no portion of those three that is less important than the other. It's a huge issue. They all have impacts, and a number of these are reproducing quite well and have populations that are growing in Utah and do impact fisheries and the ecosystems within our state. What's the cost of this action to Utah? Reduced survival of native species. We have illegally introduced redside shiners in the Virgin River drainage. We have fathead minnows that were illegally introduced in the Virgin River drainage. We have smallmouth bass that were illegally introduced there. And we have an endangered assemblage of fishes down there that we spend millions of dollars a year kind of clean those up so these native fish can live. Then there's a cost. ESA listing of native species is a cost to the state. The chemical treatments that we do, we treated strawberry for illegally introduced species that's actually native, the Utah chub. It cost over $3 million. Panguitch Lake had Utah chubs. We treated that one. That was over $400,000. We treated Cottonwood this last year for bullheads and carp that are illegally introduced there, and this is just ongoing, and the cost keeps growing. What that does is it reduces these potential places where people would go and the success they have there, and so they get frustrated, and we lose anglers and the revenue associated with those anglers at those sites, and probably on a statewide basis. Then there's a trickle-down effect that we heard about in Joes Valley, which just happened to have an illegal species introduced to it, Utah chub as well. And there are businesses there that closed down because the fishing quality declined to the point where anglers just wouldn't go there and take part in it anymore. We do have tiger muskies up there now that are making that a popular fishery again. But, you know, if those chubs weren't there in the first place, we wouldn't have had to see that decline in revenue. Then there's lower survival of stocked fish, and the difference between the cost of stocking an 8-inch fish versus a 10-inch fish is a factor of two. It costs twice as much money to raise a 10-inch fish than it does an 8-inch fish. And so by just economics, our ability to do our job and the ability to do the job for these other fisheries declines every time this act takes place. So what are we thinking about doing right now? Chemical treatments, which we do every year, physical removements, which, again, we do every year, use of sterile fish, the tiger muskie, the wiper, those are things that we're into. We're expanding those efforts as we speak. The use of super males, this is a technology that Idaho is using, and what they do is they actually create a three-chromosome male fish that they stock into waters like brook trout, for instance, where you have stunted brook trout or you have a brook trout population that you want to eliminate. You stock these super males and you put them in there, and over a period of three generations, you'll end up with an all-male species or an all-male population in there. Then if you quit stocking, it just winks out because there's no reproductive success. Then there's complete water closures. These are things we're considering, and potential regulation changes such as the catch and kill regulation that we have in place. We're also considering, possession, so that if you caught these fish, if they were illegally introduced into a water of these species, we could implement a no harvest regulation on that water. The reason that this list was created, or these are fish that people in our mind move to harvest a lot of fish. If you look at this, yellow perch, white bass, when people go fishing for those species, what they want is they want to take a bunch home. And so an act of moving white bass into Deer Creek Reservoir to have a no limit is a benefit to the fisherman because he can just take them home wholesale. This, we're hoping, would actually, in his mind, create a situation where the act isn't rewarded. And so this is one thing we're considering. This would be another thing that we've actually implemented, but this is just for these species. It'd be a catch and kill regulation. These are trophy fish, and people move them because what they want is they want, you know, their trophy fish in a water near their house. And what we'd like to do is create a disincentive for that act, which we've done in a number of waters. And so this list of waters is something that we're considering having a catch and kill regulation on in the future. Thank you.
Questions?
What's the penalty for somebody who gets caught doing that?
Which one? Stocking or moving?
I'll describe both of them.
I believe that moving is $4,000 maximum fine and a class B. And actually, stocking is a $5,000 maximum.
$2,500 class B for moving, $5,000 class A for actually putting it in the water.
Okay. Thanks, Mike. So it's $2,500 and $5,000.
And then do they lose their license or opportunity to fish on A and B for numerous years?
That is an option. I think that's within our discretion, Mike. Yes.
What do you mean by your discretion? You can either approve of it or ask the judge to or whatever?
Yes.
Are those rules set by the division or the Senate or somebody else?
The penalties, you mean? Well, our penalties are all in law, and there's always the option of increasing the penalty, but there's other actions that we can taken before you do that. Wyoming increased their penalty, but they've not made many cases. We ask them that at Tri-State this year. So just increasing the penalty may not accomplish what you're trying to do, but it is an option.
Do you actually catch some of these people doing this?
Yes. We have a case in Layton right now where we've caught a guy that is actually, you know, we caught him moving and then we caught him introducing, I believe. And we're making that case right now. Part of the problem, and I said it earlier in my presentation, you know, the penalty really isn't the answer because, you know, if you don't have a court system that's really receptive to a $5,000 fine for someone having a live fish, you know, in their live well or trucking down the road, then it's not the penalty that we need to address first. We need to educate folks because a lot of times, you know, when you catch somebody with live fish, they're either you know, given a small slap, a $50 fine, or let walk with a warning. And we just need to do a better job at educating, you know, the public, you know, the court systems, and everybody, are, you know, including the legislative folks about what an issue this is and what a cost it is to the, and then we'll get the penalty following, I believe. That's my belief.
Go ahead, Ernie.
Is this a super male technology a potential on carp and burbot?
See the smile? I'm hoping. You know, it's been done, and if it's been done on one species, I think that there's definitely potential to duplicate that. We have a fisheries experiment station that's pretty well qualified at you know, carrying on what these guys started. Carp, Utah chub, just all kinds of invasive fish. Absolutely. That's what we're hoping.
Are the other states already working on this in the universities?
Idaho's the first, as I know.
Any other questions from the board? The RAC chairs, do you have any questions? Okay. Thank you then, Drew.
One comment.
Yes.
I just want to thank Drew and the Fisheries Department, Roger, and the rest of them. I think they do a great job. People down our way always talking about how good the fishing is at Panguitch Lake and some of the others.
Very good. Strawberry. goes without saying. Okay, thank you. It's noon. Are we ready for lunch? Shall we take a lunch break? Okay. We'll take a lunch break. Be back here at 1 o'clock. We're going to continue with our agenda and then delay this hearing until we get done with our agenda. Thank you.